Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Today on the program, we're bringing you an overview, a roundup, a look at what you as a Kansas or Missouri voter need to know to make responsible decisions in next Tuesday's primary elections. We're calling it our 45-minute voter's guide. Some of this you've heard before on KCUR, but only if you listen all the time. Some of it will be new to you. All of it, we hope, will be informative and helpful. Of course, there's more where this came from, so be sure to visit kcur.org. Let's get started with a look at the race for the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate seat in Kansas. Senator Pat Roberts has held that seat since 1997, but this year he faces a challenge from Milton Wolf, a Johnson County physician who's been called the choice of the Tea Party movement, and two lesser-known candidates. Up to Date invited all four candidates to join us for a debate. Pat Roberts has steadfastly refused to debate Wolf in any forum, and we were no exception. But even if we didn't have all the candidates here for a debate, we've still been keeping an eye on the campaign. The Roberts campaign has had to deal with charges that the senator doesn't really live at his listed Dodge City address, though a state election review board has ruled that he is a legal resident. Milton Wolf, meanwhile, has experienced what others before him have, a social media faux pas. KCUR's Frank Morris reported on the blunder and spoke to political science professor Bob Beatty about it. Let's listen to an excerpt.
And then comes a video interview conducted by Tim Carpenter, the Topeka Capital Journal's lead political reporter. We see him leafing through documents with images that are blurred electronically, which show x-rays that Milton Wolf posted on Facebook. First, in this little excerpt, we hear Wolf maintaining that the images are educational. And then Tim Carpenter quotes from Wolf's Facebook comments attached to an x-ray Wolf posted showing a decapitated shooting victim.
To educate people about what happens, you know, is that not educational?
Wow, one of my all-time favorites from my residency days. Pretty active knife and gun club at Truman Med. What kind of gun blows someone's head off completely? I gotta get one of those. What professional medical education piece does that have?
So, you know what, I'll tell you something. I'll tell you the burden that you carry when you're a doctor and you have people who come to you and put their lives in your hands.
Okay.
And this is something that, maybe most people don't understand that. The burden of that. It's an honor in a whole host of ways, and it's a burden in a whole host of ways.
So, Professor Beatty, Milton Wolf is a candidate who's running as a doctor, not a politician. He's using his credentials as a medical professional to critique Obamacare from a position of authority. Does that fact make this kind of video more damaging for him?
It's in some ways ironic because the very thing that Wolf is touting, which is that he's not a politician, new to the political game, is the very thing that make this sort of thing more probable. Because, you know, ordinary Americans who may not necessarily be considering running for office do wacky things, things that may be offensive, that may not be politically correct. And therefore, those things can get them in trouble when they do run for office. And because a big-time campaign, like the Roberts campaign is going to do opposition research. And looking at that video, it's a little unclear as if to, you know, whether Wolf saw this coming. And if he did, you know, whether he understood this could be something that could derail the campaign at an early stage.
And in that video, Tim Carpenter, the Topeka Capital Journal reporter, really holds Milton Wolf's feet to the fire.
No, it isn't. You know what? It is no joke about taking care of patients. And you may,
no, sir, please address why you posted the image of a guy's head blown apart.
Tim, answer your question.
All right, let's talk about this one.
This is the kind of material you see in medical education textbooks all
Facebook.
The time. These are real consequences. You know, there are real consequences to what happens and some of the evil that's out there in our world and some of the tragedies that are out in this world.
Is this a Todd Akin moment for Milton Wolf? The way he responds to these questions, it doesn't put him in a very flattering light.
You know, I don't think a lot of Kansans are necessarily going to see this Wolf video, but what it could do, what all of this could do, is simply have him throw up his hands and say, you know what, it's not worth it.
So what do you think his prospects are now?
It was always going to be a tough race for Wolf, just because Robert has $2 million and incredible name recognition. Really, the key will be if Wolf thinks he can raise enough money to get his message out on TV. Getting on TV will be really, really important.
That was KCUR's Frank Morris reporting. Well, Milton Wolf did get out on TV, and so did Senator Pat Roberts. And in an AdWatch story last week, I took a look at some of those ads which are still playing on local television stations. Wolf and Roberts went negative early, and their latest ads reprised some old charges. Wolf has consistently questioned Roberts' residency in Kansas, a question ultimately decided in Roberts' favor by a state election review board. Roberts, meanwhile, has run ads challenging Wolf's professional conduct as a physician, including Wolf's posting of X-ray images and commentary on his personal Facebook page, a matter now under an ethics investigation by the Kansas Board of Healing Arts. But the new material in each spot centers on how the candidate's opponent has voted, or hasn't.
Pat Roberts moved to Washington 47 years ago. Here in Kansas, he rents a Lazy Boy recliner at a donor's house on a golf course. Roberts only visits
every time I get an opponent.
The Wolf campaign ad shows a Pat Roberts lookalike sitting in a recliner on a putting green watching television, part of that ongoing claim that the senator's only in-state address is a rented room in a supporter's golfside home in Dodge City. The meat of this ad's allegations appears on that screen, and an announcer intones some of the votes Roberts cast during his 33 years in Congress.
At his real home in Washington, Roberts voted for Kathleen Sebelius.
Let's stop there for a second. It is true Roberts voted to confirm his home state governor as Secretary of Health and Human Services, although so did then-Senator Sam Brownback and seven other Republicans. Now, back to the S.
11 debt ceiling increases.
Okay, that's also factually true, but maybe a little misleading. Of the 11 votes given in the ad's fine print, spanning Roberts' House and Senate careers as early as 1996, some of those were nearly unanimous. Many were party-line votes where Roberts voted with the Senate's most conservative members at the time as part of a Republican majority. And what the ad doesn't say is that economists would argue many of those votes to raise the statutory debt limit were necessary to keep the economy from collapsing. But perhaps the most contentious claim is in the last vote mentioned, alongside an image of President Obama.
Obama's fiscal cliff tax hike.
Now, hold on. That compromise bill, approved 89-8 in the Senate on New Year's Day 2013, actually prevented automatic tax increases from kicking in for most Americans. It made permanent the tax cuts of the George W. Bush administration. It did increase taxes for those making $450,000 a year or more, increased their rate from 35 to 39.6%, but that affected less than the top half a percent of Americans. It's all according to the CNN story cited in the ad's fine print, for those who bother to check. Still, Wolf's campaign spokesperson said this week that in each of the votes mentioned in the ad, Wolf would have voted no. The commercial released the same day last week from Senator Roberts' camp attacks a different kind of voting record on Wolf's part. This ad, too, reprises old charges about Wolf's ethics, and then makes this claim.
While Milton Wolf was hiding his unethical X-ray activity, he was also hiding something else. 28 missed elections.
A long list of dates scrolls up the screen next to a picture of Wolf, his flag lapel pin changed to a sticker that says, "I didn't vote."
28 times Milton Wolf had the chance to vote on important issues, but he didn't show up.
Actually, only 23 complete dates are visible on the screen, even when you watch it in slow motion, but the Roberts campaign did send KCUR what it says is a list of 28 elections in which Johnson County elections records show Wolf didn't vote.
On taxes, on water, on schools, Wolf missed 28 votes on issues important to Kansas. If Wolf didn't even show up to vote.
We checked that claim, and it does appear true that Wolf did not vote in those elections. As the ad says, most were for things like Shawnee Mission school board seats, water district commissioners, community college trustees. Wolf also apparently missed some primary and general state elections during that period, but the county records show he did go to the polls 14 times since 1996. According to records online at the Secretary of State's office, Roberts voted 32 times in that same period, including in many municipal and county elections. Since 2002, most of those votes have been cast by mail under the state's advance voting method. It's hard to tell how many he missed because Ford County's online records are less complete, but a spokesperson acknowledged that Roberts may have missed a few minor elections too, but said his record was, quote, a hell of a lot better than Wolf's. Wolf's spokesperson had no comment about the accuracy of the ad's claims, but notes that Wolf was in medical school, then a residency, then raising a family during that time period, which maybe just goes to show that facts, whether about votes in Congress or about votes at the polling place, can be true, but may not tell the whole story. Brian Ellison, KCUR News. You are listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I am Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. The winner of the Pat Roberts-Milton Wolf primary battle will face Democrat Chad Taylor in the general election in November. Today is our 45-minute voter's guide here on Up to Date on KCUR. Everything you need to know for voting in next week's Kansas and Missouri elections. And we're moving now across the state line to Missouri, specifically to Kansas City, where some of the city's voters will consider question A, which relates to the proposed expansion of the city's streetcar program. Joining us to take a look at it is KCUR's Cody Newell. He's written a summary of the pros and cons at KCUR.org, and he's going to talk with us for a few minutes this morning. Cody, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Cody, question A's complete ballot language runs for 6 pages. Give us the 6-second version. What would a yes vote mean?
Well, a yes vote for Kansas City question A would establish a much larger transportation development district than is already in place for the downtown streetcar plan. The new district would run from the Missouri River in the north down to Gregory Boulevard and then from State Line Road in the west to I-435. And basically what this would do is it would give people within that district a chance to vote for tax increases for streetcar developments extensions in November.
Okay, so since the first phase of the streetcar plan is already underway in the running from River Market to Union Station, what would a no vote actually accomplish here? What would it mean for the program?
Well, a no vote would basically stop any extension plans, to the streetcar line for the time being. It probably wouldn't kill any plans for it. There are ways that they could, reintroduce extensions. But for now, it would basically just be the existing 2 miles of track that they're putting down right now, and it would stay that way.
Now, we did have supporters and opponents on the program here earlier this week, and there's a fair amount of disagreement, I think it's safe to say. The supporters have a very well-funded campaign, lots of printed pieces. I seem to get another one every couple days at my home here in Midtown. What are the main arguments in favor of this?
Well, the main arguments are that extending the streetcar will bring jobs and development. And so proponents have said that this is a good way to kind of introduce Kansas City as a progressive, modern Midwestern city. And they're also trying to get this passed very quickly because there's some worry that if this doesn't get passed now, the streetcar has to get federal funding. It has to have 50% of its funding come from the federal government. And there's worry that if it doesn't get passed now, the federal government won't be willing to provide that funding, say, after the 2016 election.
I see. So the opponents, on the other hand, don't seem swayed by those arguments. They don't have as much funding. They haven't been getting their message out in quite as many places. What are the arguments against approving this streetcar expansion?
Well, opponents are pretty upset about the cost already that it has cost to build the line, and an expanded streetcar plan would cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million. So they're very worried about that. But they're also worried about the tax increase. So if this passes in November, people within the new Transportation Development District would vote on a 1-cent sales tax. And they're worried that this will tax people in the urban core who don't necessarily have the means to, kind of deal with that tax. Mm-hmm. So they're concerned about that.
I mean, there's an additional assessment, right, for people who live within a certain distance of the streetcar line?
Right. If you live within one-third of the tracks, one-third of a mile of the tracks on either side, your property would be assessed for, a special assessment. So that would be additional money that people would have to pay.
It takes in a big chunk out Independence Avenue, out Linwood Boulevard, as well as down Main Street.
Yeah.
If this does pass, is it the end of the story? What would happen in November to continue this progress for the streetcar?
So in November, I think it's safe to say proponents would probably spend even more money and do even more campaigning than they're already doing. But like I said, people within the new development district would be voting on tax increases and special assessments. So if this gets passed, the real test, the real kind of big vote to see if the streetcar will be expanded will be in November. So it'll be a pretty big deal for the city and pretty big deal for the project. So.
That's KCUR's Cody Newell. Up to Date, as I mentioned, hosted a debate and forum conversation on this issue this past Monday. You can listen to that, as well as read all of Cody's reporting on this issue at our webpage, kcur.org. Cody, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Another transportation issue on the Missouri ballot, not just in Kansas City, but in the entire state, is Amendment 7. That's a statewide sales tax for transportation. On Monday on Up to Date, we also hosted a debate on that issue, and you can find that at kcur.org. But in the meantime, you can find a brief voter guide there on the issue by KCUR's Ben Palisari, and he's joining us now to give us a quick rundown. Ben, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So talk us through Amendment 7. What exactly would voting yes on Amendment 7 do?
Well, it's an interesting tax because it's a statewide tax rather than a local one. And basically, it would increase the statewide sales tax by 0.75 cents for 10 years. And all of the money raised by it would only be able to be used on streets, roads, infrastructure, things like that.
Bridges,
highways, basically anything you drive on, yeah.
Okay, so that's statewide, all of that money, but locally there's some very specific implications for the Kansas City Metro?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, locally there are a couple of big projects that are earmarked in this tax by MoDOT. The first one that a lot of people are really, you know, happy about is the Broadway Bridge north of downtown. It would replace that and make it modernized and, you know, help flow traffic through, you know, north to the airport, et cetera. And the other one is that it would expand the streetcar, which, you know, we haven't seen operate yet, but it would pay to expand it. Yeah.
Right. The proponents are saying that that it would actually reduce the amount that the tax has to increase here in Kansas City to pay for the streetcar. Is that your understanding?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's basically, you know, it's you know, locally we'll be paying for it through taxes, but you know, this will help pay for more expansion through a statewide tax. So that's one thing opponents are not happy about, is that you know, you've got statewide tax paying for local issues.
Well, and I guess that is the question. I mean, who could be opposed? We have to pay for our roads and bridges. What is the opposition to Amendment 7 about?
Well, you know, the opposition is that it's a blanket tax. You know, it's something that that if you buy anything in the state, you're going to be paying for roads. You know, something opponents say, you know, is wrong about this is that, you know, if you don't drive, why should you have to pay for the roads? You know, opponents are saying, you know, the best way to pay for roads and infrastructure expansion and upgrades would be through gas taxes, vehicle sales taxes, license fees, things like that.
Some of the critics I've heard have noted, especially that truckers who have the most wear and tear on the road don't have to pay anything extra on this.
Absolutely, this does not increase the gas tax, and you know, truckers who just plow through the state on I-70, they don't pay anything, even though they're the ones that are really going to be reaping the benefits of this.
What about local municipalities that might want to focus some particular tolls or gas taxes of their own for future road improvements?
They can't do it. That's about it. I mean, you know, as much as they'd like to, this specifically says they cannot do it. So it's a statewide thing. And MoDOT has outlined, you know, you can go to MoDOT on their website. They outline every project that they want to undertake with this tax. But municipalities, they won't be able to increase local taxes to do road work.
So, Ben, even though there are some pretty passionate voices for and against this measure, on a legislative basis, it had pretty bipartisan support. Governor Nixon supports it. Give us your political analysis here. Why does this have such broad-based support if it does raise these sort of complicated tax issues?
Well, I mean, you know, politicians need the support of the people, and the people need roads. I mean, it's kind of like, how could you not support this as a politician? You know, it's sort of like bread and circuses. You know, any politician locally or statewide would, of course, they'd want to support it because everybody needs roads, especially in rural and small towns. You know, rural areas and small towns, they rely on state roads and state highways.
You can find all of Ben Palisari's primer on Missouri Amendment 7 online at KCUR.org, along with lots of other information that would be helpful as we prepare for the Missouri and Kansas primaries next week. KCUR's Ben Palisari, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So when we come back, we'll continue this tour of the Kansas and Missouri primary ballots. We'll look at more of the proposed Missouri amendments addressing the right to farm, the right to privacy, and also a lottery ticket to benefit veterans, plus your options for insurance commissioner if you're a Republican in Kansas. Also, don't forget your weekend to-do list from Brian McTavish is coming up, so stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. We continue now with our one-stop voter's guide for next week's primary election by turning back to the Missouri side and Amendment 1. Agriculture is one of Missouri's big industries, and next Tuesday voters may enshrine the so-called right to farm in the state constitution. But though right to farm amendments are focused on agriculture, they often pit farmer against farmer. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted has the story.
Jeff Jones and his daughters drive a feed cart down the hill from their house to feed their foraging cattle.
Drive them away there, McKinley. They'll come back here. Come on.
About a dozen cows saunter out from a shady grove to greet the buckets of grain. But Jones, a fourth-generation farmer, is worried about new neighbors. An industrial hog farm is slated to move in less than half a mile away. The 20-acre lot in rural Callaway County, Missouri, would pack in more than 10,000 hogs. Jones says he's concerned how it will affect the health of his livestock and family.
Much of the fertilizer will be spread on land, which will be uphill from us. So, you know, in large rains, there's going to be, you know, concerns about that coming down here and being in the water in the creek and the ditches and things like that.
It's a common story. Industrial ag and neighbors don't always mix. But Jones is worried that he won't be able to hold the hog operation accountable for problems. That's if Missouri voters approve an amendment to the state constitution. It's being called a right to farm amendment, and it could serve as a model for constitutional additions in other farm-heavy states. As proposed, it says in part, the right of farmers and ranchers to engage in farming and ranching practices shall forever be guaranteed in the state. The measure essentially attempts to protect farmers and ranchers from any new laws that would change or outlaw practices that they currently use.
Practices that are proven, that are safe, that are good for consumers, good for farmers, and good for the environment.
Blake Hurst, president of the Missouri Farm Bureau, says his organization supports the amendment. He wants to stay one step ahead of the groups that use regulation to change the way farmers do business. Some Midwest farmers say they feel under attack from animal welfare groups and environmental organizations. They're worried about their livelihood.
So this amendment is a way for us to sort of push back a little bit.
The amendment has become a hot-button issue. On one side, commodity groups like the Missouri Cattlemen's Association and the Poultry Federation. On the other, animal rights groups like the Humane Society and some small farmers. One of the issues is vague language. If the amendment is approved, it will likely lead to interpretation disputes down the road. Here's University of Missouri law professor Erin Morrow-Holly.
It talks about farming and ranching practices. So that's a rather general term. It will be left much to the courts to decide what that encompasses.
Now, if the amendment passes, farms will still have to abide by existing laws and environmental regulations. But critics say it would make the state friendlier to industrial farms with deep pockets.
Those out here in the country, we're just going to get screwed if this passes.
That's Joe Maxwell, former lieutenant governor of Missouri and head of a group opposing the amendment. He says the law could result in more power for big farmers and companies and allow them to fund changes in local laws.
If this passes, those safeguards will be under attack by those that want to build large CAFOs in rural Missouri.
Farm Bureau President Blake Hurst maintains that the amendment is meant to protect all of the state's farmers, and the opposition may be much ado about nothing. 2 years ago, North Dakota passed a similar right-to-farm amendment. North Dakota State University law professor David Sikowski says he hasn't seen any resulting court cases.
Maybe sometime in the next decades, there will be some technology that even producers are going to say, hey, wait, we really aren't sure if we want that within our industry. And at that point, this language will be tested.
Back at the farm, Jeff Jones is also looking to the future.
It is going to put even more pressure on the traditional family farms.
Ultimately, in states where agriculture is a large chunk of the economy, voters will look at what needs protection. Missouri will decide on the August 5th ballot. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
And joining us to talk a bit more about this ballot measure is KCUR's Jeremy Bernfeld. He's written a concise voter guide for Amendment 1. You can find that at kcur.org. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. So in the story we just heard, Christopher Husted mentioned that some farmers feel under attack. Can you explain that? Under attack by whom?
Yeah, you know, we hear this over and over again at Harvest Public Media when we're talking to farmers all over the Midwest. Lots of big farmers, especially livestock farmers when it comes to big hog operations, big poultry operations in particular, feel that they're under attack by animal rights groups, environmental groups, consumer groups. You know, whether it's focused on the amount of manure that these operations generate or antibiotics that they use to treat their animals, or even, you know, farmers who use genetically modified seeds. A lot of big farmers feel like they are under attack and that some of these attacks are based on science and legitimate, but some are spurious and really just designed as nuisance lawsuits from people who just don't agree with the way that these farmers are running their business.
And I mean, and who are those people? Who wants to attack farmers?
Well, I think in this case, when we talk about right to farm, the Humane Society of the United States, the national organization and other state organizations, has been come out very strongly against these kinds of amendments. I think, but as far as attacks on farmers, it runs the gamut from the Humane Society to the Union of Concerned Scientists to Food and Water Watch to, you know, all sorts of different groups. And again, some of them are legitimate based on scientific attacks who want to change the way that farmers do things, and some might not be.
Okay, so this amendment obviously could have an impact for farmers, but actually not just farmers, right? It could impact rural towns as well.
Well, I think that is a key here. It's not exactly clear, as you heard in the piece, what the ramifications of this amendment will be because of that vague language. But many expect that it will ultimately make it harder to pass new laws that regulate farming and ranching. Now, in rural areas, you're just more apt to come up against these issues, and since we don't know how this amendment will affect that kind of thing, it's really unclear what will happen in the future.
Do you think that rural areas are responding differently to this amendment than, say, well, an urban area like Kansas City?
Yeah, I think this is definitely a nuts and bolts issue for somebody who lives in an urban area. It's kind of something that they have come across, I'm sure, whether they are a farmer or whether they're not. But it's very easy when you look at this amendment and live in a rural area to think, okay, I can see how this affects me, and maybe not as much here in Kansas City or in St. Louis, that kind of thing.
Why is this such a big deal for Missouri specifically?
Well, you know, agriculture is really important to the state. I don't think there's any denying it. You know, the last agricultural census studied it, and they found nearly 100,000 farms in Missouri. We're talking about 15 million acres of cropland and really $9 billion in annual sales just in the state. So obviously, it's important to nurture that industry from an economic perspective. It's really just a question of how best to do that, and this amendment gets at the heart of it.
The supporters of this amendment have aired a couple of television ads. The opponents, I've heard, were thinking of broadcasting some in the St. Louis area. I don't think they've aired here around Kansas City. How hot will this debate be by next Tuesday?
That's a great question. I mean, we're certainly watching it really closely. As we talked about, I think it's hard for voters in urban areas to really look at it and say, I don't even know what this means, and I don't know why it applies to me. So in that sense, I think it's been kind of cool. At the same time, there is this fierce battle, and it's really going on all over the Midwest and in all of these ag-heavy states of, again, how best to nurture the industry and what kind of protection against regulation these industries should receive.
That's KCUR's Jeremy Bernfeld. You can read his primer on Missouri Amendment 1, as well as hear that feature we aired from Harvest Public Media, Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted. That's all at kcur.org. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Before we go on, I need to correct an error I made earlier in this broadcast. We were talking about Missouri Amendment 7 and the transportation tax. It has indeed enjoyed some support on a bipartisan basis from elected officials, including some Democrats, but Missouri Governor Jay Nixon is not one of them. He does not support Missouri Amendment 7, as I stated, and I apologize. Please Please don't consider him a supporter of Amendment 7. Now, moving over to the Kansas side, where voters will be narrowing the field, especially on the Republican side of the ballot, in several statewide election races next Tuesday. Earlier this week, Chris Kobach and Scott Morgan battled it out here on Up to Date over who is better equipped to face Democrat Gene Shodorf on the November ballot for Secretary of State. But Kansas Insurance Commissioner has drawn the most crowded field of Republican candidates. KCUR's Dan Margulies is here to speedwalk us through the race. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. So maybe we should just start with this. What in the world does the Kansas Insurance Commissioner do?
Well, the Kansas Insurance Commissioner has four primary functions. It first and foremost regulates insurance companies. It reviews them for their financial solvency. Secondly, it educates consumers. Thirdly, it assists consumers with any disputes they might have with insurers. And fourth, they license insurance agents.
Doesn't sound like the most exciting job, but that hasn't stopped it from attracting a crowded field.
Right. And much of the interest in the office appears to stem from one aspect of what the insurance commissioner does, and that is its oversight of health insurance. And health insurance, of course, is now a big deal owing to what's called Obamacare.
So in light of that, there are five candidates on the Republican ballot. Whoever wins will face the lone Democrat in the race, Dennis Anderson. But let's talk about these five candidates briefly. Can you give us a quick sentence or two about who these people are who want to be the Republican nominee?
Well, three of them are from Johnson County, Brian. All five appear to oppose Obamacare, although that's something of a red herring because the insurance commissioner, of course, has no power to do anything with the federal law. So while some of them outright advocate the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, none of them can do anything about it other than slowing down or speeding up its implementation. And that's the rub. I mean, that's where the insurance commissioner becomes a central figure in the extent to which Obamacare is implemented in the state of Kansas. The current insurance commissioner, who is a Republican, Sandy Prager, actually supports Obamacare.
Right, and has actually, as part of her job, taken it to interpret Obamacare to Kansans mm-hmm. and actually has worked to implement as much as she has been permitted to by the legislature.
Exactly. She is something of an outlier. As I say, all these five candidates do oppose it, although only one explicitly advocates for its repeal.
So we've got Beverly Gossage, David Powell, Ken Selzer, Clark Schultz, and John Toplicher. Dave Toplicher. Tell me about give me a sentence about each of them. Who are they and why do they want this job?
Well, Gossage is an insurance agent from Eudora, and she is probably the most extreme, I think it's fair to say, of the five candidates. She is utterly opposed to Obamacare. Mr. Powell is an insurance agent from El Dorado, Kansas. He is opposed, although not as vociferously as she is. Ken Selzer is a CPA and a former Fairway councilman, and he is big on increasing insurance competition in the state. Clark Schultz is a state senator who wants to see what he calls double taxation of insurance companies in the state repealed. And Toplicher is currently a Johnson County commissioner who used to be in the state legislature.
All right. So in general, you've mentioned that they all sort of seem to have the same standing, same position on the Affordable Care Act. Is there really a wide spectrum represented by these candidates, or are they mostly cut from the same cloth?
I wouldn't say they're exactly cut from the same cloth. As I say, the extent to which they oppose Obamacare varies. But they're also crucially all opposed to the expansion of Medicaid in the state, which is a big issue that's going to be coming up again and again. There are several hundred thousand Kansans who are currently enrolled in Medicaid, but the Supreme Court, having made expansion optional when it upheld the Affordable Care Act a few years ago, Kansas is one of the states that has opted not to expand Medicaid to 138% of the federal poverty level. As a result, a good 100,000 or so or more Kansans who would otherwise be eligible for Medicaid are not.
So there are some pretty significant implications for who who is elected and the power they might have to implement some.
Correct. And again, we're confining ourselves to talk about health insurance. And of course, the insurance commissioner oversees more than just health insurance. But that is certainly the lightning rod in this race. So I can't really parse how these candidates differ from one another, because they don't seem to differ all that much. I'm assuming the Democrat, the lone Democrat, Mr. Anderson, supports Obamacare. And so it really is going to come down to the question of whether it's going to be the Democrat or the Republican who's elected to the office.
All right. Well, then I guess the question, Dan, is what do you think this Republican race will come down to? How is a voter to decide?
Well, I don't know how a voter is to decide. I don't know if you're asking me to predict what the outcome will be, which I'm certainly not going to attempt to do. But I think voters have to look very carefully at their records and what they say, and make a decision about who is going to be the most reasonable. I got to tell you something. This office has been around since 1871. There's only been one Democrat in the 20th century who occupied the office, and that is none other than Kathleen Sebelius, who, of course, used it as a springboard to become governor of the state of Kansas and subsequently Secretary of Health and Human Services, overseeing the rollout of Obamacare. So, this is an important office in many respects.
That's KCUR's health editor Dan Margulies giving us a quick primer on the candidates for Kansas Insurance Commissioner on the Republican side. Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You can read the full version of that report online at kcur.org. Now let's jump back to ballot issues on the Missouri side. There are two other amendments we haven't talked about getting a lot of attention. Amendment 8 would create a new lottery ticket to fund the Missouri Veterans Commission, and Amendment 9, the Privacy Protection Initiative, proposes to change the Missouri Constitution to protect emails and other electronic forms of communication. Marshall Griffin of St. Louis Public Radio has a summary of both.
First, the Privacy Protection Initiative. The Missouri Constitution currently states that citizens, quote, shall be secure in their persons, papers, homes, and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures, and no search warrants shall be issued without probable cause and without describing the person, place, or thing to be seized. If passed by voters, electronic data and communications would be added to those protected items. The proposal was initially co-sponsored by GOP House member Paul Kurtman of Franklin County.
I think most people understand that with the emails that they have and with the text messages that they're sending, with all the communications that we have, I think that people are going to understand that this particular proposal is just a way for us to bring our Constitution in line with today's technology. That's really all it is. It's a common sense issue.
The GOP-penned proposal is also backed by the American Civil Liberties Union, which often butts heads with Republican politicians. Jeffrey Mittman is executive director of the ACLU of Missouri. He says the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling requiring a search warrant before police can search someone's cell phone is a step in the right direction, but that Missouri's proposed constitutional amendment will go further.
There are technological and digital and electronic communications that go beyond our cell phones. The kind of information we might share on Facebook or tweets we might send, all of those are deserving of and need the robust protections that we expect.
The ballot measure received strong support from both Republicans and Democrats during this year's legislative session, although some House Democrats voiced concerns over whether it's necessary to change the Constitution to protect emails and other electronic data. The Missouri Sheriff's Association is officially neutral, although their executive director, Mick Covington, says they feel there's nothing within the proposal that would infringe or harm their ability to serve the public. Missouri voters will also decide whether to create a new lottery ticket that would be used to help fund the state's veterans' homes, cemeteries, and outreach programs. If passed, the Missouri Lottery would begin selling the special ticket by July 1st of next year, and all net proceeds, about 25 cents of every dollar, would be deposited in the state's Veterans Commission Capital Improvement Trust Fund. The legislation creating the ballot measure was sponsored by GOP House member Sheila Solon of Blue Springs.
The lottery ticket will restore full funding for our veterans outreach programs, which has been dramatically cut due to shortfalls in funding.
Solon also says Missouri's 7 veterans homes are at capacity and that more than 1,800 vets are currently on a waiting list hoping to someday move in.
And also, it hopefully would help us to build up that fund so that we could maybe build a new home Our veterans are aging. We're having a growing number of our Vietnam veterans now who are needing care at our veterans' homes.
The Missouri Veterans Commission is officially neutral on the proposal, but their spokesman, Daniel Bell, says commission members would be happy to have any money derived in an appropriate manner that would help veterans in Missouri. The proposal did receive some heavy criticism on the House floor earlier this year from Democrat Jeremy LaFavor of Kansas City. He called the proposed lottery ticket an inefficient way to fund veterans' needs. If passed, Missouri would join Illinois, Iowa, and Kansas in selling lottery tickets that fund the needs of veterans.
That was St. Louis Public Radio's Marshall Griffin with his summary of Amendments 8 and 9 on the Missouri ballot next Tuesday. Joining us to talk just a little more about Amendment 9, the Privacy Protection Initiative, welcoming back here KCUR's Cody Newell. Cody, you've got a primer on this subject as well up online at kcur.org. Clarify for us, what exactly are the kinds of data and electronic communications that would be protected if Amendment 9 passes?
So if Amendment 9 passes, the types of things that would be protected are things like text messages, your private messages on like social media sites and things of that nature. Emails also would be protected.
Are those things clearly not protected now, or is it they're just ambiguity?
It's just kind of ambiguous at this point. So far, you know, the way that unreasonable search and seizure law works, it's just your home, your person, your personal belongings, things of that nature. It doesn't mention your data or anything like that. So right now, you know, if you were being searched, law enforcement wouldn't have to have a warrant to look through your text messages or look at your emails.
We heard in that report from Marshall Griffin that there was bipartisan support in the legislature. We heard the ACLU is on board with this proposal. Who is opposed to it, and why?
Well, the some of the main opponents that I found, doing the primer on the website, the Kansas City Star's editorial board said that people should vote against it because the way that a constitutional amendment works, it's very broad, and it's not necessarily something that's going to specifically say, this type of information is protected, this isn't. So it's maybe just a little bit too vague for their liking. Also, they're just worried about legal battles that could happen. A federal agent is operating in Missouri, it's kind of unclear whether or not they would have to follow the same rules. It's just very very uncertain.
I see. So I guess the question then is, why is this amendment coming out now? I understand there's a Supreme Court case that recently dealt with the privacy of cell phones, whether they can be searched. These are very present issues nationally, not just in Missouri.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's coming up right now. I talked to Representative Paul Kurtman, and he said that we just haven't really had a chance to bring our laws up to date. And so now is kind of a good time to do this in conjunction with the Supreme Court cases, because it kind of presents Missouri as this, progressive state that's actually, getting on this issue, and we've kind of let it go for a long time.
That's KCUR's Cody Newell giving us a little bit of a roundup of Amendment 9, the Missouri ballot question. That, along with all the other matters we've talked about this hour, will be on the ballot next Tuesday, August 5th, both in Missouri and Kansas. There is one other Missouri ballot issue we didn't talk about here today. That's Amendment 5, the Right to Bear Arms Amendment. We will have a primer on that subject going up later today, along with all this other information at kcur.org. Cody, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.